Welcome to the We Have a Meeting podcast, where we sit down with the world's smartest thinkers to give you the actionable tools, insights, and strategies that could make your life more impactful and productive. This week, we have a meeting with...
Brace the rudders! Raise the sails! Raise the sails!
Captain, an unidentified ship is approaching. Over.
Roger. Wait, is that an Enterprise sales solution?
Reach sales professionals, not professional sailors. With LinkedIn ads, you can target the right people by industry, job title, and more. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next campaign. Get started today at linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Elise Hugh, host of the podcast TED Talks Daily. For more than 20 years, Paylocity has been leading the way with cutting-edge work solutions like on-demand payment, which offers employees access to wages prior to payday, flexible time tracking features, which enable staff to clock in and out through their mobile device, and numerous other cutting-edge solutions that simplify collaboration across HR, finance, and IT. Learn more about how Paylocity can help streamline work and enhance business outcomes for your organization at paylocity.com/simplified.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With a message for everyone paying big wireless way too much. Please, for the love of everything good in this world, stop. With Mint, you can get premium wireless for just $15 a month. Of course, if you enjoy overpaying, no judgments, but that's weird. Okay, one judgment. Anyway, give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. Intro rate first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See full terms at mintmobile.com.
My sister came to work for me about 4 years after we started. And after a month, she was like, "Is it always this bad?" In the August, literally the entire month of August, one person walked through the door of the shop on Savile Row. Wow. But we've got to the point where it changes so rapidly. You know, you've got brands like Shein launching 2,000 new products every single day. You know, you get to that point, that's not fashion anymore. That's just stuff. We can't make a kettle where the switch doesn't fall off after 6 months. You know, it's like, what have we done here? We're paying money to do things that used to be people's jobs. And that seems like a really perverse way to live. You were either a noble or you were a serf. And it didn't matter how hard you worked or how much money you had. You were sort of stuck.
It felt like you took a massive risk to go and buy a tailor's. At the time, was it a risk or was it actually, I know it'll work out?
Every time we pick our phone up, we see somebody that's got more shit than us. And it breeds this sort of gnawing sense that we're not good enough.
Patrick Grant, welcome to the We Have a Meeting podcast. I've been very excited to get you on. I'm going to hit you with the biggest question that we ask all of our guests. So you need to be prepared for this one, Patrick. Who are you and what problem do you solve?
Oh, Jesus. The problem that I'm trying to solve, I don't know. It seems to get bigger all the time. I mean, when I first started out, I was trying to solve the problem of, you know, just making some nice clothes. And then... As my career went on, it was like make some nice clothes and make them affordable to people and try and create a load of jobs and save a load of jobs. And now it feels like I'm taking on the whole of, you know, late capitalism, trying to rebuild a fairer and more equitable society through changing the way we think about consumption and quality and everything else. So, yeah, it's supposed to get easier as you get older, but it seems like I just, you know, the portfolio just keeps getting broader.
It definitely feels like you're a man on a mission. I'm going to chuck one of the lines from your book, a quote, and kind of see what it means to you. So you said the work we do and the places we do it play a big role in our happiness. So I guess what does that actually look like for you?
Well, I think the interesting thing is that I started. So the book came out of a TED talk, which came out of the thinking behind community clothing. So I started community clothing. I started community clothing in 2016, having taken over an old
clothing factory in 2015. It was one of our suppliers, a company called Cooksman Clegg, that had been in Blackburn since 1860. So it had an important role to play in the history of the town. It had an important role to play, obviously, for its staff, but also the broader ecosystem of businesses it supplied to and it was supplied by. So, and all businesses are important, no matter what their size. They all mean, you know, they all have meaning and purpose to, you know, a constituency that's broader than a lot of people think. And it's always been my view that business ought to do good things. You know, when I studied for my postgrad, there was a big movement behind social enterprise. And, you know, I think it lost a lot of momentum in the financial crisis of 2007-08. But I feel like it's back on the agenda again. And I had always been of the opinion that work was much more important to people than just money. You know, and when I came to Blackburn and when I went to all the various towns that that we work, where we have factories that we work with, it's really clear to me that work is much more important to people's happiness and well-being than simply the paycheck. You know, the work that we do has a really fundamental role in how we see ourselves, how others see us, and how we feel useful to society. And I think the interesting thing is that over the last 50 or 60 years, a lot of people who had jobs where they could see the usefulness of themselves to society and where others could understand what they did, the number of people doing those jobs has diminished greatly. The number of people doing jobs where there is a tangible output at the end of their week's work, where they can look back and say, that's what I've done this week, has fallen off. And the number of people actually working with their hands and minds has also diminished massively in the last 50 years. And it corresponds with a great increase in levels of anxiety, depression, levels of mental health problems in society. And I don't think the two things are unconnected. I think when we have jobs that we enjoy and where we do something we can feel proud of, it makes us feel better. I think where we do jobs where we work, particularly where we work with our hands and minds, that practical application of knowledge and skill leads to a sense of well-being that a lot of people have forgotten about. And it's interesting when I meet people who work in making industries, how, you know, anecdotally happy they all seem compared with the norm, which is an increasing level of discontent with our work. And it feels to me something really interesting, again, that sort of came out of thinking about the research for the book and just the way we behave and live now. We've got to a point where lots of people with money and a bit of time on their hands are now paying to do things like upholstery or making furniture or throwing pots or going on thatching courses. We're paying money to do things that used to be people's jobs. And that seems like a really perverse way to live. Like, why don't we just do the jobs and get paid to do them? And the result of all of that would be a change, you know, a change to the way people are paid, change the way we pay for things, the pain, you know, the price of goods would go up, but the price of, but the value of those goods would go up considerably. And I feel like we're forgetting that the money that we spend and how we spend it can do lots of good things. And, you know, I know that people who buy things from, you know, from sort of artisan makers feel a sense of happiness in that themselves. And so I feel like the way that we've built our economic, the sort of economic bones of our society have moved us away from happiness giving work and happiness giving consumption into sort of empty consumption and empty work. And that feels like it was, we've sort of walked into it without really thinking about it. But if we wanted to, we could change back again. And that's part of what the book is all about.
So it sounds like what you found was with a sense of purpose and pride, that's where true happiness is.
I think for a lot of us, I think there are, you know, there are lots of routes to happiness. And happiness is an interesting subject to be talking about in the context of business. And I think it's something that a lot of businesses are now starting to think about. And, you know, not just in the context of the happiness of their staff and the happiness of their customers, which are important things to all businesses, but just their role in the overall kind of well-being of society. I mean, it's interesting that you look at the indices of happiness across different countries, and there is no correlation at all between wealth and happiness. You know, some of the poorest societies on the planet are some of the happiest, and the richest societies in the some of the richest societies in the on the planet are amongst the least happy. And it's an interesting phenomenon that the more we have, the more we want. And as a result, the greater our anxiety and feeling of sort of, the feeling that we want more grows the more some people have. And particularly, I think now that we live in a world where, you know, it's very visible. The wealth of other people is very visible. It gets pinged into our phones. You know, every time we pick our phone up, we see somebody that's got more shit than us. And it breeds this sort of gnawing sense that we're not good enough, that our lives are not good enough. And we have to somehow find the means to acquire more stuff to get make ourselves happier. But actually, the things that genuinely make us happy, we know what those are. I mean, firstly, hanging out with your friends and family, spending time with loved ones, that makes us happy. Going for a walk on a sunny day, that makes us happy. Looking at the birds in our garden out the window and having a cup of tea, that sort of stuff. Listening to music makes us happy. But also craft makes us happy. I don't know why craft pops up in these things, but craft is making. Making things makes us feel happy. And we used to have, most of us used to have jobs where we made things. We either made things or we grew things or we looked after animals. I mean, going right back to the beginning, we either worked in growing or looking after our food or making the things we needed to process that stuff. I mean, we had pretty basic needs. We needed food, shelter and clothing to keep us warm. And we were all employed in doing that in one way or another. But as society has moved forward, many, many more of us have become increasingly kind of stuck in jobs that have no sort of real connection with the way human beings actually operate. And it leaves us feeling somewhat disconnected. And I think we've been studying happiness for quite a long time, surprisingly. And in America, I think they've been studying it for 60 or 70 years. They've been asking people how happy they feel. And the interesting thing is that the wealthier America gets, the less happy people become. And then you see all of this other stuff. You know, you see the rise, you know, you see this great sort of fracturing of society. You see the rise of extremism. You see the rise of very deliberate sort of segregation within society, and big things like, you know, Brexit and Trump and things, I think, are a result of a lack of kind of just basic happiness amongst people. You know, if we were all dead happy, we wouldn't give a stuff who else had what. You know, if we all got up in the morning and thought, oh, I can't wait to go into work and thatch a roof or, you know, throw a pot or wherever it happened to be, fix a car, you know, we'd probably spend less time worrying about what everybody else had or did.
What role do you think, I'm sure you're someone who's met many, many people who are chasing some form of status, whether it's through can I wear the best suit or perhaps further down the line in other things you've done in your career, what role do you think chasing status plays in this?
I presume you, I mean, yeah, race? We're not talking about the band here. I think interestingly, you see certain moments in history where things start to change. And I think the idea that, I mean, status used to be fairly fixed. Like, you know, you were either a noble or you were a serf, and it didn't matter how hard you worked or how much money you had, you were sort of stuck. But then, of course, society changed, and you know, you could buy your way into a sense of status. And now it feels like anybody can rise to whatever level they want to a certain extent. Well, certainly it's a lot easier than it used to be. But as a, you know, as a result, acquiring a sense of status through consumption has become a thing that we've, you know, that has been sort of rooted in society. And I think there are interesting things about the way we consume. I mean, people with very little money consume quite a lot in order to try and make themselves feel part of this sort of way that society works. People with lots of money, particularly those with new money, again, spend a lot of money. I mean, it feels like the people that spend the least are the people with the oldest and the kind of, you know, people with old cash don't spend any of it at all. You know, they'll wear their clothes till they're sort of hanging off them in rags, and they'll fix things and they'll do all that sort of stuff. But it's, you know, for lots and lots of people, buying stuff has become part of a route to feeling happy about themselves through the status that it sort of shows them. And you see that in branded clothing. You know, what is the difference between a black hoodie that has nothing written on it and a black hoodie that has Balenciaga written on it? Well, it's all in our head. I mean, of course it's all in our head. The only difference is a tiny bit of ink. But it does mean things, and it's important to a lot of people. But that sense that is important has been very deliberately fostered by those people who worked out that making us buy more stuff all the time is going to make them richer. And I think there's a sort of growing divide between businesses, I feel. And I think it's particularly interesting at the moment because the fashion industry, particularly a lot of the luxury fashion industry, is falling off a cliff right now. You know, valuations at LVMH and Kering, Gucci, Burberry, they're all taking an absolute nosedive because, you know, they are businesses that have to continue to grow and continue to make bigger profits and have higher turnovers. And I think there's a real divide going. I think that, you know, I think I'm not a degrowther by any stretch of the imagination. You know, businesses, I think it's perfectly good for businesses, you know, successful businesses to get a bit bigger. But it shouldn't be the ambition. The ambition, I think, should be for businesses to deliver good to society. And as a result of that, those that do ought to thrive. But we've created a situation where lots and lots of our businesses can only survive if they continue to increase their profits and increase their turnover. And that drives behavior that's really, really bad for all of us. And it feels to me like we're going back round to the point I was, you know, where we were when I went to business school in the very early 2000s, where we are looking at the role of business in society, and we are there is a sort of divergence between businesses that are set up to do good things, which then go on and thrive, and businesses which are set up to make money, which then try and backfill some sense that they're doing something good in an attempt to con consumers into continuing to support them and buy the shit that they pump out.
It's a fascinating one. I was watching I'm sure you might have seen it, the Netflix documentary about minimalism.
I haven't seen it, actually, no.
Brilliant. And it's really minimalism at its finest. Like, we're talking a few items. I guess what does... It felt like that was one of the big lessons from the book, and like avoiding fast fashion and focusing on like fewer quality items. I guess what does that look like in your world, I guess, on like a daily basis?
Well, I think the issue that I've got, and again, it's been interesting because the book came out in late May, and I've done a lot of talks around the country. I've been interviewed about it by lots of people with interesting and different points of view, and different things have resonated with different people. And there has always been it's been an interesting starting point in conversations. And it's made me have continue to think about all of the things that I've written in the book, because I think they're all things that they're important to me in the way we run our business. And we run our business on the basis that what we want to do at every point is do good things and deliver good value. I think the interesting thing about fashion is that The idea of fashion, this idea that you are sort of conning people into requiring new stuff simply for the simple expedient of you selling more things and making more money, is becoming something that I think people are becoming somewhat tired of. I think it's interesting because it's been a few hundred years that we've had this idea of very deliberate fashion, but we've got to the point where it changes so rapidly. You know, you've got brands like Shein that are launching 2,000 new products every single day. You know, you get to that point, that's not fashion anymore. That's just stuff. That's just this sort of endless tidal wave of low quality shit that just is getting sort of washed at us. And we're all sort of, and I think a lot of people are starting to see that there's no good in that, really. Like, the important thing is, but there is a place for fashion if it's done in a way that it creates value all the way along the chain. And I think this is the point that this is the thinking I'm coming to now, that you can have fashion. It's okay to have fashion, because I think it's quite natural as a human being to want to change your clothes. You know, as we grow up, as we go through life, we move from place to place. We might want to change the way we look. It's perfectly normal and natural. You know, in the natural world, other animals are, you know, putting leaves on their heads and adorning their nests and doing all sorts of things in different ways. There's something quite primal about that, and there's nothing inherently wrong with it. But the problem has gotten that the way that works, particularly in the clothing industry, but it's the same in homewares and furniture and all sorts of stuff now. I went to, I saw a poster for IKEA yesterday, and it was like, I can't remember the word. I actually took a photo. I'm going to have a look because the wording was interesting to me. And what did they say? We've always got something new for you. It's like, well, is that good? Like, is that the way? Is that a good thing? Like, do we want to be constantly feeling like we haven't got the right stuff in our houses? Isn't that just making us all feel bloody anxious? I mean, it's the point I get to now is that I think it is okay to want to change things, but you want to do it in a way where all of the things that are created and sold create value. They create value in the run up to the point at which they're sold. So in the way in which they're made. So, you know, it's perfectly good to make an object, you know, where the material that it's made from is sourced in a way that does some good. You know, it provides a living for farmers in, you know, places where cotton grows or places where wool is farmed. And, you know, as long as that is done in a way that isn't harming the environment and isn't causing, you know, poverty conditions to be laid upon these people. And it isn't, you know, at the moment we've got this massive problem with Kashmir, for example, because basically they've over-farmed Kashmir so badly that they've got twice as many Kashmir goats in the same amount of land. And it's killing the ecosystem completely. You know, it's the sort of stuff that we just, so as long as all of that creation and the way that these, you know, the way that the clothes are made, the people who make them are paid well for their labor and for their skill and their knowledge, and that the people who design them with some care, with some view to them being objects of lasting value, not just things that are kind of utterly ephemeral. And that once you've bought it and worn it, it will have a long life, either with you, because it has been made in a way that means you're not going to feel bored of it instantly. And if you wear it for a long time, it isn't just going to fall apart. But also, if you then decide you're bored of it, someone else is going to want it. You can pop it onto eBay and somebody else will pick it up in a heartbeat, and it will continue to have value for a very, very long time. And I think that is the important thing in all of the things that we buy and sell. Have they got lasting value? You know, have they been designed in a way very specifically to give them a chance to have a long life? And have they been designed in a way so that their manufacture and the things that they're made from only do good stuff? Because there is plenty of opportunity. Like, we all need stuff. But the problem is, most of the things that we're being sold are made in a way that only cause bad shit to happen in the production. And once we've worn them once or twice, no fucker else wants them. You know, it's like no one on the world. I won't name the brand, but I was at a conference in Glasgow last year, at Glasgow Uni, about textile recycling, which in effect, you can't recycle textiles economically, but you can give them to somebody else and somebody else might want them. But we've got to a point where there is so much of this stuff on the planet already that all the places we used to ship the stuff that we don't want to, they no longer want it. So we used to ship ship about half of all the clothes we gave away to charity shops and put in clothing bins to sub-Saharan Africa, Indonesia, South America, places like that. They've got enough. They've got way more than they can possibly deal with. So they just don't want any more. So literally, I mean, I won't name the brand because it feels unfair to pick on one in particular, particularly in something that's being recorded. But, you know, what he said was no one on the planet wants secondhand beep. And, you know, insert any one of those ultra fast fashion, low cost products. No one in the world. It is just rubbish. It literally has to then be incinerated or go to landfill because it has no value past the point at which I've worn it once or twice.
Wow, it's making me. I know Zach only shops at charity shops. This is from a thrift shop. I have been guilty in the past of having my top man sprees and stuff like that, and it makes you think. I wanna talk to you a little bit about risk. So obviously, like your entrepreneurial journey, when I was following your story, there was a fascinating point about obviously, like, it felt like you took a massive risk to go and buy a tailor's. At the time, was it a risk or was it actually, I know it'll work out?
Well, you know, it didn't feel like a risk. I know, but it was. I mean, it was. I just finished a postgrad degree, and most of the people finishing my degree were going off to earn loads of money doing stuff like work in hedge funds and be management consultants for people like McKinsey and whatnot. But I decided to buy a knackered old tailor's, having never run a tailor's before, but having had more than an interest in clothes my entire life. But I think it's one of those things where if you feel the risk, you're probably not the right person to be doing it. I think you get a sense when you meet other people who have that same sort of kind of entrepreneurial mindset. You don't see the risk. You only see the vision of what the thing is going to be in the future. And that's another thing that sort of I found very interesting, because it for a long time, it wasn't until somebody pointed it out to me that not everybody sees the things that things are going to become in the future, that is something that only certain people do. You know, when I took over Norton & Sons, in my head, I was seeing it as the business it was going to become after we'd sorted all the problems out. So that was what I saw. How I got there was something to be worked out. But, you know, you get you have a sense in your mind of the thing it's going to be. And so that's the thing that you're occupied with. I think if you're the sort of person that thinks, well, really is, you know, is 10 grand in the bank going to be enough to sustain us through the next what might be 3-4 years of trials and tribulations? The answer probably was absolutely not. And if you're the person that goes, well, shit, that's a problem, you're not going to take that leap and do it. And it was the same when I started community clothing. In my head, I could see, I mean, I still imagine what it's going to be, you know, even probably 10 years from now, when, you know, all of the kind of growing pains have been gotten over. And, you know, I mean, I've had this vision of these sort of campuses of spinning mills and weaving sheds and clothing production things and academies where people learn to do stuff on some sort of Google-like campus with lakes and trees and, you know, people growing up in a place like Blackburn sort of dreaming of going to work in the clothing industry because they make amazing stuff and people all around, you know, value what they do, and it's only doing good things. That is, I can see it very clearly in my head, and you know, every day I go to work, I'm thinking, right, what are we doing today that's going to move us towards that situation? You don't really think about, well, I certainly didn't think about the risk. My mum thought about the risk a lot, and she thought I was nuts. My granny was more like me. She was like, yeah, I'm sure you'll make it work. So, you know, crack on. But and a few of my friends, you know, who I went to when I was trying to raise money to buy Norton's were like, oh, yeah, I'm sure this. Yeah, you can probably sort this out. This will be all right. But there are times, you know, you get into doing the job and things come along which trip you up all over the place. And I think, you know, in the 20 years now that I've been running my own business or businesses, there have been all sorts of occasions where things have gone horribly wrong. But if you thought about all of those at the beginning, you just wouldn't do it. You know, if you think about all the times you've had to deal with horrendous situations that, you know, most of the time are outside of your control anyway, you wouldn't. I mean, my sister came to work for me about 4 years after we started. And after a month, she was like, is it always this bad? And I'm like, what do you mean? And she's like, we've got no money. We're never more than a week away from running out of cash. I'm like, oh, that? Oh, yeah, no, that's always like that. So it's like some people are sort of made for it and some people aren't.
Fascinating. I think that resonates with me and Jack run a business together, and that's been our journey as well. You go, oh, my gosh, is it all over? And then you think, oh, no, we're fine the next week. So, yeah.
Well, it was the same with Norton's. It was like, you know, I remember the first summer. So I took it over in December, and in the August, literally the entire month of August, one person walked through the door of the shop on Savile Row.
Wow.
And I was like, well, you know, and everyone was like, oh yeah, August, they all bugger off on holiday. Nobody's coming in to pick up suits or order suits or whatever. And I was like, oh God, we're done for here. And I phoned a customer of mine who had 4 suits on order. He was actually a customer in Spain. And I said, oh, hello, Mr. So-and-so, you know, your suits are ready. And he was like, oh, great. I'll be in maybe second week in September. And I'm like, oh God, second week in September, the doors might be shut and the lights are off. But I actually went to the bank and said, look, you know, we need a bit of extra to see us through this thing. And actually they gave us a slightly bigger overdraft and we got through it. But, you know, just there's always a time where you think that's it, we're done. And then one person walks through the door and, you know, makes an order for 20 grand and gives you a 10 grand deposit and things are fine. I mean, that was also, it's interesting because when I was running Norton's, the numbers were relatively small. But now, you know, Community Clothing is a much, much bigger entity. And it's not anything now where I can sort of dip into family savings and get like a few grand to tide us over, you know. You know, the scale of the problems we have, we've had a very, very, on the financing side of the business, it's been unbelievably difficult. On the public facing side, on the product side, it's been brilliant. You know, our business has grown loads, but you know, in the background, particularly post COVID, you know, there's been all sorts of challenges that, again, I was one of those people when I worked in my pre sort of entrepreneurial days, when I had a job where I was on a salary. I was always the sort of person where if something went wrong, I'd be like, right, okay, here's all the things that are wrong. Here's how we're going to fix them. And I think that's the mindset you have to have if you're going to run your own business, if you're going to take a risk, put your own money behind it. But at the end of the day, the way I see it is, I mean, sort of what is the worst that can happen? If you love money, you probably shouldn't be an entrepreneur. You know, I think because at the end of the day, the worst that can go wrong is you can lose it all. I mean, again, you feel more responsibility the bigger it gets because there are more people's jobs at risk and there are more suppliers dependent on you. And now, you know, with Community Clothing, we have the factories that we work with. There's about 2,000 people employed by the factories that we work with. Our own team is very small, but the, you know, on the supply chain side, we're the biggest customer for quite a lot of our suppliers. And if we did fail, it would have very serious repercussions. So you do feel that pressure. But also the more you do it, the more you learn that you can only control the things you can control. You work as hard as you can all the time. You make the best decisions that you can. You put the hours in. You do everything as well as you can. And, you know, you hope that things go well. And on the whole, touch wood, I've been very lucky. You know, there have been bad things. There have been plenty of bad things. But the good things have far outweighed them.
Do you find that in your business career, there's certain problems that have come up, like you said before, knackered old tailor, once I get these problems out the way, we'll be laughing. Are there certain business problems that pop up that you think, that's a Patrick problem, I quite like getting my hands dirty with that kind of thing?
Well, I mean, there are certain things you can do. I mean, I think you find, I mean, certainly running Norton's, I was an absolute generalist. I was doing everything. You know, one of the things we had to do was just run the business with a tiny team. And I did, you know, I did all the accounts, I did all the everything. But I think, you know, I don't really know. It's hard. I think, again, when you're an entrepreneur, you probably have to be reasonably good at quite a lot of things. And then it's a question of trying to make sure that you balance the time that you spend doing things. But, you know, I'm always a great believer in, you know, in being upfront and honest with everybody about these situations. I think, again, telling people things, you know, not hiding bad news. There are lots of people I've worked with over the years who were really bad at giving bad news. I think bad news needs to be out on the table as soon as it comes along. And, you know, people are always very generous. I think if you're honest with the people that you work with, and I mean that with all the partners that we have outside of our business, you know, there are always tough things that come along. And I think as long as you are, I think a level of personal integrity and honesty. I mean, we went through a liquidation with our businesses a couple of years ago post-COVID. But, I made absolutely certain that everybody who was involved, when we restarted, we got the money. And the first thing we did was we made sure that everybody got paid. And, you know, I think we're a business that tries to do good. And that has to extend through the way we behave all the way through our business. And I think, you know, I think I don't know what I'm particularly good at. I mean, I think I'm good at designing clothes. I'm quite good with spreadsheets. You know, I did an engineering degree. I'm quite good at maths. But I think I've always kind of had a reasonable sense for what the right, you know, where the right, what, where the way the wind's blowing, like in a sort of bigger sense. And I think we're at an interesting sort of crossroads. Again, as I say, I think we're at an interesting crossroads in the sort of history of capitalism. Because I think it's a moment where the good businesses that set out to do good. I think the difficult thing is, you know, I think there are big businesses that would probably prefer to be doing things that were a bit better than they're doing. But it's very difficult to you know, you can't shove a square peg in a round hole. And the interesting thing is that it has got easier for businesses to get themselves off the ground. And, you know, particularly in this country, it is easy to start a business, I think. And there is still a bit of money around, happily, and some of that money is looking to do good stuff. And so businesses that set themselves up with the very express interest in not necessarily chasing the greatest amount of profit, but in doing something that is of benefit to society and or the planet, are businesses that I think are going to flourish, where you design a business model that doesn't mean you need to do bad things in order to continue running your business. You know, it's interesting that the number of people that are starting businesses where social and environmental goodness is at the heart of the idea. And it's like, I think there is a great opportunity for those businesses going forward, because consumers increase. I mean, we're just at the end of another COP, another round of COP. And like we've got to change the way we do this stuff, but it's got to be down to individuals, because governments are still, you know, at the behest of those with the money, and for a lot of those people, the status quo is the best option for them and their further enrichment. But I think greed, I think we've we're also at an interesting point where people are starting to question, you know, personal motivations. You know, is being greedy a good thing? And I think for a long time, it was sort of okay to be greedy. You know, particularly, I think the 1980s allowed the idea of greed and money to become something that were real driving forces. But I think we've got, you know, a society growing up now that that maybe has different motivations. You know, I think we see it in the behaviours of teenagers and young adults. They actually do want a different outcome. And so they're going to put their money behind people that are more aligned with their personal view on what's right.
Patrick, I love this. I feel like there's so much to take away. And I think it's definitely, we were speaking about your mission at the beginning. And I definitely can see this utopia that you're working towards. And even if you change.
I mean, it does sound a bit mad, doesn't it? To think that, but you have to, but this is the thing. Like, you have to believe that you can do some good. Because if we all believed that we could do some good and we all actually tried to do it, then good would happen. I mean, often people are like, well, why would I bother, you know, washing out my recycling? These other fuckers don't do it. And it's like, well, but no, that's the wrong attitude. We all have to believe that a better, fairer, more equal society that doesn't fuck the planet up is actually possible and do everything that we can to do it. And if we all did that, it would actually happen. I mean, it's kind of easy. If everybody stopped supporting the bad stuff and only gave their money to, you know, if they did decide to just support the few good things that we're doing, I mean, we would change it instantly. You could change it tomorrow.
It's moving the needle forward one bit at a time.
Yeah.
I'll ask you one last question before we let you go, Patrick. I'm always fascinated behind the books and the learnings that are probably created this mindset. So the young Patrick, what were you reading? What are some of the things that kind of give you this killer entrepreneur that focuses on changing the world?
Well, I talk a little bit about it. I mean, in fact, weirdly, it's on the bookshelf behind me there. There's a book up there called How It's Made. And that was a book that, I mean, I loved books about how you make good things. I mean, my first degree was in material science and engineering. So it was all about how do you make a good object? How do you make an object that performs really well, that is enjoyable to use, that continues to serve its usefulness for a really, really long time? So what do you make it from and how do you make it? That's always something that's been fascinating to me, and it continues to be. You know, I think increasingly I feel absolute, you know, sort of, I mean, it just drives me nuts that we know how to make things so well, yet most companies sell us absolute dog shit. You know, in every area of our life, the quality of the everyday things we buy has just fallen off a cliff. Like, you know, we can do the most extraordinary things, yet the basic things that we all buy are now so much worse than they were 50 years ago. Like, you know, everything, like you can't, like, we can't make a kettle that the switch doesn't fall off after 6 months. So, you know, it's like, what have we done here? Like, we've allowed greediness and profit to get in the way of making things really well. And making things well is, of course, the best for people because they get paid well to make good things. And it's also the best for the planet because you consume much less. You've got much less pollution and all the rest of it. It's so mad. But there was another book. There was a book that I read when I was researching my book. And I mean, the interesting thing about writing that book was quite a lot of it was my own thinking. Quite a lot of it was my learned experience from 20 years of working in the clothing and fashion industry. Also, it was my experience as a consumer and somebody who cared about good things. So, the book is split between, you know, a story about consumption, a story about work and a story about quality. And all of those things, I think, are linked to one another. Very explicitly. But there was another, as I was going through writing and researching, I'd have conversations with people and people would say to me, oh, have you read such and such a book? And I'd go, oh, no, I haven't. What's it about? And they'd say, oh, it's about this and that. And then I'd go and I'd read a little extract on Google and I'm like, oh, shit, I've got to read that. So I ended up reading, I don't know, like a meter and a half's worth of books in about 3 months. I was absolutely plowed. I was like being back in my postgrad again. plowing through social and economic history books and all sorts of stuff. I read a book called Small is Beautiful by a guy called Fritz Schumacher. It was written in the, maybe late 60s or early 70s. I can't remember exactly. Have I got a copy of that here somewhere? Oh, I do. Hang on. I'll tell you exactly. The subtitle, so here it is, Small is Beautiful by E.F. Schumacher, A Study of Economics as if People Mattered. I mean, wow. It's such a, if you haven't read it, I swear to you, you'll thank me for reading it. It's absolutely brilliant. There are so many bits in it that you're like, what the fuck? This was 50 years ago we were thinking this stuff. And this was a big seller at the time. This was not a small book. Schumacher actually worked in the UK. He was German, but he worked in the UK, and he worked for the Coal Board. And he was a very forward-thinking sort of political economist and philosopher. But he was looking at the way society functioned and how we all interacted with it in a way that was so prescient. But it's so relevant today. So I suggest that there's quite a bit of Schumacher in certain bits of my book because it's so good. But it's interesting that there's so much that was written so long ago. I mean, things like Silent Spring by Rachel Carson. Like, we knew that we were killing the planet with pesticides and herbicides again 60 years ago, but we haven't fucking done anything about it. There's another really good book called Limits to Growth, which again was talking about the planets. We're going to hit on hard limits. And it's interesting, like the UN and other organizations now talking about soil depletion. And, you know, we're now getting to a point where we're reaching a sort of, well, we've probably reached a sort of epidemic of plastic pollution and all sorts of things like that, that again were widely discussed and widely read. You know, these were best-selling books in their day, but something happened and we just stopped. We just were like, oh, well, you know, we can leave that for another day. But that other day is now. And, you know, we as business people, I think, have a responsibility to take action. You know, it's action that is required now, not philosophizing and discussing. And I think that's, I think that's for me the thing that stands out most. Like, I haven't got that many years of working left, and I'm going to use them to the best of my ability.
I feel inspired. I think it's a strong mission, Patrick, and I feel honoured that we've been able to have you on today to kind of share this with our audience. If people want to check you out or get a copy of the book, obviously we'll put links in the box below.
Right.
But where else can people find you, Patrick?
Well, I mean, if you want to hear more of me sort of rattling on about this sort of stuff, Community Clothing, I write a weekly newsletter for Community Clothing. You can find me. I'm on Instagram. The book, both I've three books, but the book that we're talking about here is a book called Less, which is available pretty much everywhere in the UK. It hasn't been published anywhere else yet, but
soon.
There is an audio book available on Audible, which I recorded. Quite hard work recording an audio book. It's a lot of talking.
I can imagine. You're a busy man. Patrick, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
Cheers, Patrick.
Hey, I'm Elise Hugh, host of the podcast TED Talks Daily. For more than 20 years, Paylocity has been leading the way with cutting-edge work solutions like on-demand payment, which offers employees access to wages prior to payday, flexible time tracking features, which enable staff to clock in and out through their mobile device, and numerous other cutting-edge solutions that simplify collaboration across HR, finance, and IT. Learn more about how Paylocity can help streamline work and enhance business outcomes for your organization at paylocity.com/simplified.
You set the gold standard for your business. Your website should do the same. Wix puts you at the helm so you can enjoy the creative freedom of designing your site just the way you want. Want someone to bounce your ideas off? Talk with AI to create a beautiful site together. Whatever your business, manage it from one place and tie it all together with a personalized domain name. Gear up for success with a brand that says you best. You can do it yourself on Wix.
Get this. Adults with financial literacy skills have 82% more wealth than those who don't. From swimming lessons to piano classes, us parents invest in so many things to enrich our kids' lives. But are we investing in their future financial success? With Greenlight, you can teach your kids financial literacy skills like earning, saving, and investing. And this investment costs less than their after-school treat. Start prioritizing their financial education and future today with a risk-free trial at greenlight.com/listen. Greenlight.com/listen.
Our books are now open. Friends, Romans, countrymen, if you're looking for more sales, and that might be getting more meetings in the diary, meeting more of the right types of people, or breaking into a new area or sector, we've got you covered in two key ways. Number one, we can do it for you. We can kick the doors down, get you the meetings, and do the prospecting that you hate. Or number two, we can teach you how we do it so you can do it for yourselves, creating repeatable, predictable results. So if you're interested in either of those things, www.wehaveameeting.com and hit the contact us form. Speak to you soon.